heard two new recordings by Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. Ella Fitzgerald, who we just heard singing Some Other Spring, was featured with the Count Basie Orchestra minus Count Basie. It's 5 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. On the Alec Wilder series this afternoon at about 5 to 4, the singer's going to be Mark Murphy, and the subject will be the songs of Cy Coleman. Joining me now on Fresh Air is documentary filmmaker Robert Drew, who in the early 60s left his job as a Life magazine editor to start making independent documentaries. He used the new, more portable video equipment of the period and tried to take advantage of its mobility and of its ability to go behind the scenes and not call attention to itself. His 1960 film Primary, about John Kennedy's bid for the Democratic candidacy, departed stylistically from many other documentaries of the period by aiming for a candid feel and using a minimum of narration. His next major film, Crisis, Behind a Presidential Commitment, explored the conflict between George Wallace and John Kennedy during the integration of the University of Alabama. His 1966 film, Storm Signal, studies the lives of two heroin addicts and their young son. This film won first prize at the 1966 Venice Film Festival. This film will be screened tonight at the Walnut Street Theater along with excerpts of the other two films, and this will be as part of the Walnut Street Theater's series, The Documentary in Television. Robert Drew's screening and discussion begins this evening at 8, and that's at the Walnut Street Theater on 9th and Walnut. You can call 574-3550 for more information. Drew Associates, Robert Drew's company, is currently producing films for NBC and IBM and other corporations. He's also working on features now for Primetime Saturday, and that's the show that used to be Primetime Sunday and is now on Saturdays. Robert Drew, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your early films were considered an early part of the American direct cinema movement. How would you describe that movement?
Well, I was an editor for Life magazine and a correspondent. And the people I worked with were the Life photographers who shot candid pictures, Gene Smith and Leonard McComb and other people like that, Eisenstadt. And it struck all of us when television began doing documentaries that the documentaries did not have to be staged and lit and set up the way they were then, and a lot of them are today even. And it would be possible to get, if it were possible, to get really candid pictures of people really living their lives, we might be able to make the documentary interesting, which it wasn't then, and I don't know how much more interesting it is today to people in general, but if you actually could share experiences with people, and if you'd have the possibility for interesting documentaries. So I began working on the problem. The first thing I did was make a half-hour film for NBC, but I had to use the old system because we didn't have lightweight equipment, and the photographers at the time insisted on being on a tripod, and it really took about 8 men to shoot a documentary film, and I found I made a film, and Ed Murrow's See It Now was on the air at the time. And I thought I was going to make a better film than he was making, and I didn't. And that confused me a bit. And so I took a year off on a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard to sort of restudy the problem, because candid photography was only sort of one part of the problem. And I studied the short story and the stage and the novel, and wound up realizing that if we shot people candidly, if we could successfully do that, we would then have to edit differently. We'd have to edit without the narration logic that was the basis, logical basis for documentary. And we would have to shift into a more dramatic logic. I don't mean hyping the story, but I mean telling the story in terms of characters within scenes, with progressions, things that happen. So after that year, I went back to work for Life, armed by then with a theory of how this could progress, and a real conviction that it could be done, and started putting together the talents I thought it would take to do that. I would say that the first problem was equipment. You know, I didn't simply discover video equipment sitting there ready to be used. I had to take cameras and cut them down and make them lighter and make recorders that would synchronize with the cameras and find microphones that would reach out and pull in the sound and so forth. So the talents I assembled were first of all, Richard Leacock and Don Allen Pennybaker, his sidekick at the time. And between the two of them and a mechanical genius named Bogdanovich, we began hacking up our equipment and putting it back together again. And finally arrived at lightweight equipment we could go out and hopefully move around with, shooting sync sound. And we finally made the first film, which was Primary, and we will show a piece of that tonight.
What was the audience and the network reaction to the film? Did it look very different than the other documentaries of its time?
Yes, it did. I don't think we'd ever seen the sync sound camera. Do you know what I mean by that, sync sound? Yes.
Why don't you explain it?
Well, we'd seen cameras moving with people, but we'd never seen cameras moving with people personally in such a way that you could hear their breathing and hear what they had to say and sort of be with them. And so when Leacock and I went out with Kennedy, we were in the car and in the bus and in the and every place he went, we were. And the equipment worked, and the film had a radically different look. And in fact, it was a sort of stunning film to people in the industry. It changed the way films were made. So I hope that answers your question.
Sometimes with documentary films that are using smaller cameras and that are handheld, so that you don't have the precision of a tripod, people complain about production values, that it doesn't look as perfectly packaged as it could have if some of the documentary values were sacrificed for the look of things, for a more steady camera, more perfect framing. Did you get any criticisms like that with your early films?
Yes, tremendous criticisms. I mean, since people had never seen the camera move like that before, the huge numbers of people hated it. But then an interesting thing happened. The French New Wave cinema began picking it up, and it began hitting here in a very self-conscious fashion. Cameras were flying in and out of French Citroëns, and lovers were making love while the camera twirled around them and so forth. And then an English film, Tom Jones, hit the screen, and Tom Jones was took all the faults of our films and elevated them to great virtues. And by the time people had been shocked by these high production value French and English films, ours began to look steadier and calmer and more intelligent. And two things happened. We got better, and the equipment got better, and people became more used to seeing that sort of thing.
How did you get around the problem of the narrator? Because many documentary films relied and still rely, and this was both on radio and television, many films and many radio programs don't do this, but many still do, have the narrator setting up the story and taking you through scene to scene, particularly in places where they haven't been able to make a connection without someone stepping in and explaining what that connection is, or giving you information that's left out of the scene as it was shot, and guiding you through the program as it goes on.
Yes, yes. Well, there are two extremes. One is the movie that you go to see Star Trek or something, and the movie has no narration because all of the narrative needs are taken care of in what you can see and overhear. And the other extreme is the completely narrated documentary, which was the old style, in which everything is explained to you and laid out. And even today, when you see Dan Rather taking over from Walter Cronkite, you're seeing one narrator take over from another narrator. And a lot of people imagine that to be film storytelling, the proper form for documentary, even today. And somewhere in between those two is Citizen Kane. I don't know if you remember the movie, but Orson Welles took the liberty of explaining his way between scenes that didn't exactly fit together. And I would say that the best documentary today falls somewhere between Citizen Kane and the movies. Usually, particularly on television, you need a little narration to tell the viewer what the context is, at least, of what he's seeing. And because we're not perfect yet, to bridge certain things which we didn't, can't bridge. So it's a constant battle to reduce the amount of narration, but I don't think perfection has been achieved, or maybe will be.
It's difficult to impose a perfect order on a chaotic, real circumstance. And if you don't have time to show the whole unraveling of events as it existed, sometimes I guess the only way to give that information, which has been edited out, is to have a narrator stepping in.
Well, yes. It's if we were better than we are, we wouldn't have to do that. But
what's wrong with a narrator? Since we're talking about how to get around a narrator's presence.
What's wrong with a narrator is that he's dull. First of all, what's wrong with documentaries is that they're dull. They can be virtuous. They can be on the side of God. They can be for motherhood and patriotism, whatever you value. The documentary can expound for you. But if it does it in words, it's a lecture. And lectures are dull. And there's no way around that. And what's interesting on television or any visual medium is a drama. Is seeing characters in action within stories and that have a progression. That and humor. Humor can be completely verbal too, but so what's wrong with narration is that it's dull. And the more you rely on a narrator, the duller it's got to be. And that's
a general rule.
But
I've heard narrators, though, who have this like fire in their voice or trying to like stir up what might have been a dull documentary, and through this authoritarian stirring try to arouse it. You know, that a narrator isn't necessarily...
he's even duller than the other kind. A guy who's trying to sell you a bill of goods, which is what you're talking about, is even worse than a guy who's just giving you information. The narrator really, his only legitimate role is to be of service to the film, not to carry it.
I've heard a lot of people involved with television say that the documentary film is essentially dull and needs to be enlivened or just given more of a sense of drama or entertainment to it. As someone who's been very committed to the genre, do you seriously feel that way, or do you feel that that maybe for a mass audience, when you're talking about a nationwide primetime audience, that it might not have the appeal of a variety show, but that's comparing two very different things. You don't expect a variety show to do what you expect from a documentary film.
I think if documentary film were doing its job today, we would be gripped by it. I think we'd be moved and shaken and informed, and our emotions would be exercised by the documentary just as much as they are by fiction. More so. Because it's real. Now, that takes a development of the form which we haven't arrived at yet, but we've gotten a lot further than you're seeing in the air at the moment.
How do you get around the problem that the feeling I get nationally, the most gripping kind of real-life programming is the tragedy, someone's house just burned. You see it on the news all the time, too. Someone's house just burned. You go over with a mic and say, "What's it like? Your family's dead. Your house is burned. How do you feel?" And someone is sobbing hysterically and says, "Oh, I feel terrible. My life is ruined." And it's gripping. But this...
No, that's what's wrong.
Okay.
What's wrong is that you're trying to be both things. You're trying to be the narrator, and you're trying to interpose yourself And you're trying to get these things by direct query, which is verbal, and it's nonsense. I'll say this, that if you were with a woman at the time that her house caught on fire and truly recorded every act she took and every expression on her face and every word she said throughout the whole process of trying to get herself and her children out of that place and save it, and then realizing that it's gone and then reacting to that whole thing, and you simply did it perfectly, recorded it, and edited it as it really was, you would have a stunning document which people could empathize with.
What are some of the subjects that have moved you to make films about them?
Well, I have a series of themes that seem to have certain things in common, but one of them is competition. Whether it's political competition between Kennedy and Humphrey or Nixon and Rockefeller, or whether it's sports competition, Eddie Sachs at Indianapolis, Phil Hill at Le Mans, a football game in Florida, performing, the behind the curtain and in front of the curtain, and those moments in between move me for some reason. We made a film on Jane Fonda. She was a movie actress, but she decided to open on Broadway in a comedy. And we did the story of her opening night on Broadway. Well, it actually was the month surrounding that opening night. But aviation. All of these things, I suppose, come out of my childhood. Before I was 10 years old, I'd been moved by all of the things I've just mentioned. And one of them was aviation. So I made a lot of aviation films, testing airplanes. And then finally, music and cult and dance. We made a lot of films about, I mean, Edward Villella at the New York City Ballet and Duke Ellington on the Road, things like that. And it's hard to say that my interests led to my making films on those subjects. But on the other hand, that is because a lot of these assignments came from the outside. I had no way of predicting it. AT&T would ask me to make 9 one-hour specials on the arts. But they did. And ABC and Time Inc. and other people assigned me to make films on airplanes. But I found that if you have certain seeds in your mind, they have ways of drawing lightning. And so there's a strange combination of internal and external.
What are the expectations when someone, whether it's a network or a private corporation, commissions you to do a movie? How much say will you allow them to have in the direction of the film and the look of the final piece?
Well, that depends a lot on who I'm making it for and what their purpose, what my purpose is and their purpose is. I made 6 one-hour specials for ABC News, in which ABC News had the final editorial control, and they never once asked me to change a thing. They did agree in advance on what the subject was and my general approach. And I made a 30-second commercial for a corporation in which the ad manager and the agency chief and 3 or 4 other Indians all wanted to make changes throughout the whole 30 seconds. If I'm the editorial chief, I take the responsibility and I don't expect interference, really. But where I'm serving somebody else's purpose in a commercial, it's their postcard. And so in that case, I'm sort of trying to render their vision somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do too much of that, but I do some.
Some of the things that you started with your movies, started using portable sync sound equipment and aiming for a real candid look with the films have really, those ideas have been developed a lot, and the technology has developed in such a way as to make these candid films much more possible. What do you think of some of the cinema verite films of the past few years that have been produced? What are your standards for evaluating a good cinema verite film, a good documentary from a bad one?
Well, what we've got now is the broadest possible range of the use of this equipment and technique. And on one hand, you find people making films which are completely controlled, but with this equipment and trying to make them look like they're uncontrolled. And on the other extreme, you've got people who are dedicated to getting it as it is and putting it across the way it was. And you have all gradations in between. And I think how the medium is used is dictated by the character of the filmmaker. Some filmmakers simply can't keep their hands off. And other filmmakers simply couldn't put their hands on the subject. And generally, I think what we're getting today is a lot of directed stuff, which is being called cinema verite. And if it isn't directed firsthand, you know, I tell you what to do, it's directed secondhand. I give you expectations, general expectations, and then I watch you work them out your way, but still I've given you the direction. In my own field of interest excludes about 90% of what you see today, cinema verite. I'm just not interested in seeing other people's experiments in controlling other people. I'm very interested when I see a piece of work which is really captured something and is putting across something very strong and very honest. And some of that is being done, but not as much as I'd like to see.
Would you be able to give us an example of a film that you think works very well, or one that you think fails?
Well, finally, yes, I can. I'll give you an example of one that works pretty well. ABC broadcast a film last year called, I think, The Death of Little Big Man. It was a film made by lawyers from MIT or Harvard. It wasn't a film, it was tape. And they taped a trial, and they taped the main characters in the trial. And then Tom Bywaters, who was a producer at ABC at the time, was handed the job of editing probably 100 hours of film into a tape into a 90-minute show. And it was really real. You know, they really captured it. And I would have, if I were talking to Tom Bywaters, I would get into small details, but generally it was a great piece of work. Now, the one problem is that candid films, the kind of candid films that I've made in the past, are really hard to make today because they're so, you could burn film at no expense practically. Today, it's really expensive and difficult to get backing for that sort of thing.
In your early films, you worked with John Kennedy twice. What kind of subject was he for this type of candid shooting? Was he trying to be really savvy in front of the character, in front of the camera, and playing the image that he'd want to project to an American viewing public?
Well, for me, Kennedy was about the perfect character because he was himself. I mean, as much as I knew or saw of him on camera, I mean, off camera, as on camera, behind the scenes, in front of the scenes, he was all the same man. Unlike Nixon, who would be red behind the screens and green in front of it, or his size and shape and the whole conformation would change from minute to minute. Kennedy was the same guy. And as a subject for candid photography, that was good.
Has your experience been that the kind of person like Nixon, who really works hard at presenting a certain image to a camera, do they present that image to the more candid camera, or is a candid camera able to penetrate that?
The more Richard Nixon is exposed to the camera, candid camera, the more devastating it is, and. I suppose I can say this. at one point, Nixon backers came to me and asked me to make these campaign films. And I told them, frankly, that I had traveled with Nixon for Life magazine. I told them, frankly, that candid photography was what I relied on, and that their candidate wouldn't benefit from that. And what I got back was, oh, well, he's changed. So I had to admit that if he's really changed, maybe it would be good for him. But I suggested somebody they might go to, and they did. They went to this fellow who was a very good filmmaker and makes candid films. And he made a candid film on Nixon, which they should have paid to have burned, you know.
Which film was
it? It was devastating.
Did they show it?
Yes, they used it as a campaign film, and it was just, you know, devastating.
What made it devastating?
Well, there was one scene I remember where Nixon enters a hall with people in the hall, and in about five moves presents five different faces, and the camera is just rolling the whole time. There's not even a break in the film. And that I realize we're on the air, and this is radio, and a lot of people who weren't there don't have the opportunity to rebut what I'm saying. And all I can say is that from my standpoint, from my reading of this candid piece of film, it was not good for Nixon.
If you could control one or all three of the commercial television networks, what kind of space would you allow for documentaries within the programming schedule? And what kind of documentaries would you really be after?
Well, first thing I would do is start the development of a documentary form which would capture high-powered real life. And I would press it until I was getting tremendous one-hour specials. And then I would start programming them as rapidly as they came along. And I think it might take a few years to rank up the talent and rank up the equipment and get everything cranking, but I think a network could be programming regularly, weekly, certainly, one-hour specials that would draw audiences and do a tremendous job that isn't being done.
The word high power trips me up a little bit because I think of my life and my friends' lives, and I think of how many hours of the day aren't exactly high powered. You know, you're sitting and reading or sitting and working, or you're on the phone with someone, or you're eating and reading a magazine. Not really exciting stuff. And a lot of life is like that. It's just not really gripping, but it's real. Now, how do you get around that if you're looking for high powered programming?
Everything you see in the movies and everything you read in novels or books has its counterpart in real life today. And if you seek into the areas of real life where important things are going on, you'll find people who are living through what is for them high voltage time of their lives. That's the kind of selection process, I imagine, as a basis for this kind of journalism.
So you think that the documentary should go for those high voltage moments?
I think, yes. I think that the news reporting should sort out who can do what best, and each medium should do what it does best. And print should, New York Times should continue to publish the facts, and Life magazine should continue to publish the still pictures. And the television should continue to have the nightly news show. But in addition, it should do something that only it can do, and that is the finding drama in real life and reporting it well.
What do you think is going to realistically happen to television and the documentary during the 1980s?
I think we're pretty close to seeing breakthroughs. Television has taken the techniques that I was talking about that we developed really, and is putting them to use in what it seems to me to be funny ways, but they're marvelous. The nightly news show, the Vietnam, you actually did see Vietnam War, some of it, candidly, pieces of it. They do have candid cameras rolling, and they are getting character. but it's in pieces and snatches, but the pieces are getting better and longer, and it seems to me that it's a matter of time. Maybe the magazine show phenomenon, 60 Minutes in the top 10, there's 60 Minutes doing it dead wrong, according to my theories. They're featuring four men, and these are four talkers, and they go out and stand in front of four cameras and so forth. But they're getting some high voltage stuff anyway. And when they begin to make mistakes and start short circuiting their own system and produce some, sooner or later, something ought to grow out of that.